Black Agenda Radio, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, will be back next week. Coming up, a human rights delegation reports on the various ways the United States violates the rights of its citizens. And the nation's most prolific writer on Barack Obama expects more and worse of the same for the next 2 years. But first, the Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations recently held a march and teach-in on Haiti in New York City. One of the speakers was the activist and journalist Ashley Smith. He says it's a lie that the United States, France, Canada, and the United Nations are trying to help Haiti in her time of need.
In reality, the U.S., the other great powers, and Clinton are largely to blame for the social conditions, the poverty, the oppression, the exploitation in the country of Haiti. They're to blame for these social conditions that turn the natural disasters into social catastrophes. That's really the heart of the matter. The U.S. has imposed neoliberal free market plans on the country, impoverishing the vast majority, its peasant majority, its urban working class, and its urban poor. They waged an unrelenting campaign against every single attempt to reform and better the country for the benefit of its vast majority. They made a pact with Haiti's morally repugnant elite. That's what Haitians call the Haitian ruling class, the morally repugnant elite, to stage coups against the movement La Balasse and its democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, twice in 1991 and again in 2004. And since the quake, instead of helping its victims, they've actually policed the country, enlarged the occupation, a six-year-old occupation since 2004. They have reneged on their promise of aid and have left the population vulnerable to the storms and the cholera epidemic that we've seen erupt in the last month. They only care about Haiti insofar as they can exploit the country's poverty. That's their only concern in Haiti. And they also want to send a signal by their occupation to the rest of Latin America that they will not tolerate any challenge to neoliberalism, any challenge to the free market, any challenge to their domination and control of the entire hemisphere, because they're under a threat in exactly the way that O'Malley talked about. The U.S. got its butt kicked in Iraq, it's getting its butt kicked in Afghanistan, and as a result, it's lost control of Latin America, which is going to the left. Reform socialist governments and challenges, and the U.S. wants to reassert its control. That's what the U.S. is really about in Haiti. It's not about Haiti. It's about sending a signal that the U.S. is back in business of dominating the entire hemisphere. And in fact, the entire history of the U.S. in Haiti proves these points. The U.S., along with France, strangled the country after its first successful slave revolution. They were afraid of a precedent that would spread around the world of people rebelling against the early stage of capitalism in the way O'Malley talked about it. And France began the strangulation of the country by demanding reparations to France for the loss of its slaves. In today's dollar amounts, it amounts to $21 billion that they imposed as a structural adjustment plan on Haiti at its very birth. They tried to strangle the country at its birth. And the U.S. in the 19th century invaded and occupied the country countless times, and most dramatically in the beginning of the 20th century, occupied it from 1915 to 1934, oppressing the country, robbing it its bank of the gold, as O'Malley talked about, and certainly not for humanitarian reasons. The U.S. never does anything for humanitarian reasons. And I think it's best to quote them when they're honest about what they're actually about. And there's a famous Major General Smedley Butler. I don't know if people have heard of this guy. But he told the truth. He went from an architect of imperialism to an anti-war activist as an ex-officer from the U.S. Marine Corps. He described his life as a major general in the Caribbean this way. He said, "I spent most of my time being a high-class muscle man for big business, for Wall Street and for the bankers. In short, I was a racketeer for capitalism, a gangster for capitalism. I helped Mexico, especially Tampico, save for American oil interests in 1914. I helped make Haiti and Cuba a decent place for National City bank boys to collect revenues in. I helped the raping of half a dozen Central American republics for the benefit of Wall Street. During these years, I had, as the boys in the back room would say, a swell racket. Looking back on it, I feel that I could have given Al Capone a few hints. The best he could do was operate his racket in three districts. I operated on three continents. That's what the U.S. was about in its first occupation of Haiti. And ever since then, really, the U.S. has backed the morally repugnant Haitian elite, and especially the two criminal dictators, the Papa Doc Duvalier and Baby Doc Duvalier. And they used this regime as a counterweight to Castro's Cuba during the Cold War. And the real bad business that Bill Clinton got involved in, especially, begins in the 1970s. Not first under Clinton. He was just partying in the 1970s on Club Med resorts with the morally repugnant elite. But what they got Baby Doc Duvalier to do was to implement the beginnings of a free market plan for Haiti that really has devastated the country. It was an already poor country because the history of imperial strangulation, but it got worse under Baby Doc Duvalier and the free market plans. Essentially, what the U.S. did was say, we need to cut all the tariffs on your agriculture. Open it up to subsidize U.S. agricultural exports, especially rice. Then we need to take World Bank loans and IMF loans and build sweatshops in Port-au-Prince to turn Port-au-Prince into an export processing zone for Disney, for Rawlings Baseball corporations and other corporations like this. And then we need to build more tourist resorts so people like Bill Clinton can come and party on their honeymoon, although it's unclear whether he actually ever did go on his honeymoon in Haiti. He has contesting accounts in his autobiography of whether he actually did that. Slick Willie never told the truth about anything, including his honeymoon, so we're a bit unclear about what he actually did. This neoliberal plan enriched the Haitian ruling class, but it destroyed the standard of living of Haiti's peasant majority, its working class, and produced the conditions that we now see in Port-au-Prince. Peasants were unable to compete with U.S. subsidized agriculture, especially rice, that flooded into Haiti. The peasants left the countryside and were driven into Port-au-Prince in particular. So the population of Port-au-Prince swelled from 144,000 in 1950 to 2.5 million people today. But the sweatshops only produced at their best between 80 and 100,000 jobs. So the people went from destitution into the countryside to abject poverty in the city, in the shanty towns like City Soleil and some of the other shanty towns that surround Port-au-Prince. Thus, U.S. policy is directly responsible for setting the social conditions of impoverishment, lack of jobs, poverty in the countryside, and in the city. But Haitian peasants and workers wouldn't take it in the 1980s, and they rose up and built a mass movement called La Valasse that Kim Ives and other people have written so much powerfully about, that toppled Baby Doc Duvalier dictatorship, drove him from office, and then in 1990, Jean-Bertrand Aristide, who became the spokesperson for this mass movement, La Valasse, won overwhelmingly in the first open, free, and fair democratic elections in the history of the country on a program of social reform, raising the minimum wage, improving agricultural conditions in the countryside for Haiti's peasants. But the U.S., both Republicans and the Democrats here thought this was a profound threat to U.S. imperialism. So George Bush Sr. starts it, and we have like a bad cop, good cop routine between the Republicans and the Democrats in relation to Haiti ever since. So the bad cop, George Bush Sr., backs a coup against Aristide in 1991. And the coup leaders engaged in a campaign of slaughter against this mass movement, La Valasse, and to anybody who had supported the Aristide government. Out of humiliation, Bush reluctantly imposed sanctions, but they were some of the leakiest sanctions on a coup regime in the history of humanity. They were doing plenty of business in Haiti. But what Bush started to do is jail all the refugees that were flooding out of Haiti, thousands upon thousands of people, flooding the horrible, horrible repression of these coup leaders who were slaughtering people in the cities and the countryside. And what did they do? They jailed them in Guantanamo Bay, just like where we see the prison camp today. They built that prison camp originally to house the Haitian refugees, and they also put them in Chrome Detention Center in Florida. They jailed people instead of giving them welcome, opening arms, fleeing the dictators. And Bill Clinton gets elected in 1992, and this is where his ignominious role in the history of Haiti begins as a key leader of American imperialism, and he plays the soft cop to Bush's hard cop. He ran for office promising that he would no longer jail the refugees in Guantanamo Bay. As soon as he gets elected, what does he do? Continue to jail the refugees in Guantanamo Bay and Chrome Detention Center. And he dragged his feet on doing anything against the coup leaders. But he finally decides to restore Aristide to power in 1994, mainly to stop the refugee crisis, because it was a political problem back here at home, and also to restore the credibility of American imperialism by saying, oh, this is a benevolent, humanitarian intervention to bring democracy back to Haiti. But you can see very clearly that he was not serious about that at all when you look at the stipulations he put on Aristide when he did return to power. He demanded that Aristide moderate any social reform program, accept neoliberal measures, the Paris Economic Plan, and in particular get Aristide to lower tariffs on rice, which Aristide does when he returns to Haiti. This is what Clinton recently cried crocodile tears about. If you read, when actually Kim Ives did an interview with him, and Aristide says, Clinton says, oh, I think that was a mistake, I think that was bad, but don't believe Clinton ever when he cries crocodile tears or promises anything, because in reality he's continued, as I'll talk about, to implement the same and advocate the implementation of the same free market agenda in Haiti. So Aristide balks at a lot of what Clinton demanded, but Préval, Aristide's ally and successor, implements as much of the neoliberal free market plan, deregulating the economy, privatizing state industry, and opening the arms of the country to U.S. and other multinational corporations. Thus, Clinton got the leaders of social reform to implement the opposite on the restoration of them to power. Aristide runs again for president in 2000, winning an overwhelming victory with, again, promises of social reform, raising the minimum wage, building schools, building more hospitals, and again, we get the hard cop response. So George Bush Jr., Shrub, is in power now back in the United States, and he plays the hard cop, so immediately imposes sanctions on this desperately poor country to stop the threat of social reform, to stop the threat of even minor improvements of people's standard of living. And he escalates this when Aristide begins to demand reparations. In today's terms, $21 billion, the reparations for what France originally stole from Haiti back in 1825 as the condition of independence. At that point, then the U.S., France, Canada, and the United Nations basically say it's time for Aristide to go. So they start a classic destabilization plan. They have the sanctions that are starving the country of any trade and aid. Then they support the bourgeois opposition, the Group of 184, and help train the death squads that stormed through Haiti in 2004 and lead to a coup in which the U.S. government and its handpicked security team inside the Aristide Palace kidnaps Aristide, flies him to the Central African Republic, and now to exile in South Africa. That is, the U.S. conducts a second coup against Aristide. And that's right at the moment after they're conducting, at that point in Iraq, a successful regime change, and they want to do that throughout Latin America and the Caribbean. So Haiti was supposed to be the first step for what was going to be a rolling imposition of U.S. power in Latin America. In Haiti, the U.S. imposes a brutal coup regime and enforces it with 10,000 U.N. troops that make sure that the U.S. is going to be in control of Haiti indirectly through the U.N. troop presence. Préval, René Préval, Aristide's ally, gets elected again in 2006, but this time as a quisling, this time as an obedient puppet government of the neocolonial occupation in Haiti. Thus, the U.S., when you look at this history, has impoverished the country, stymied every single step of social reform, undid the democratic will of the vast majority, and have turned Haiti into the most deregulated free market economy in the Western Hemisphere, and therefore also its poorest economy in the Western Hemisphere. Thus, Haiti right now, the United States rules Haiti as a colony. It's bypassing the Haitian government. If you look at where all that supposed aid is going, it's not going to the Haitian government since the earthquake. It's bypassing the Haitian government to non-governmental organizations to provide charity relief. And this is important to understand because instead of the aid empowering a Haitian government that could do something like social reform, reindustrializing the country, developing social welfare plans, building a sewage system, etc., all the money is going to the Red Cross and to other NGOs that are essentially subcontracted to by the governmental power, so that now we have 10,000 NGOs in Haiti that are essentially a surrogate state for the United States. So thus, Haitians call Haiti, their own country, a republic of NGOs. That is, these are unaccountable organizations that are accountable to the international imperial powers, to the big corporate donors that control them, and not to the Haitian people. And these NGOs have utterly failed Haiti. As they've grown in number, the poverty of Haiti has dramatically increased. So instead of providing any kind of solution, they are actually part and parcel of the problem. Like missionaries at the dawn of imperialism, they're handmaidens of imperialism today. And you can see in Haiti where they live. They're in the swank hotels. They drive around in fancy SUVs. They have fancy headquarters. And they have tremendous salaries compared to the regular population in Port-au-Prince and the rest of the country. So the U.S. then brings its soft cop back, Bill Clinton, yet again, to run Haiti. So in 2009, Clinton gets appointed U.N. Special Envoy to Haiti. And then what's his plan? His generosity to Haiti is to implement the same old free market plan that destroyed the country to begin with. And he comes up with a plan with a guy named Paul Collier, who wrote a book called The Bottom 6 Billion, which is very popular in development circles. And essentially what Collier argues in his book, The Bottom 6 Billion, is when you have a failed state, what you need to do is organize a military occupation. You need to take control of the government, and you need to implement, whether the government wants to or not, an economic development plan on free market lines. That's what he actually argues in his book, The Bottom 6 Billion. He teams up with Bill Clinton to come up with a new free market plan for Haiti, and it's the same old plan. What he wants to do in the countryside is build export-oriented plantation agriculture. Plantation agriculture, when you think about what that means in Haiti, all the way back to when it was founded as a slave colony by France, it's insulting to begin with. And it's not going to address the real problem in Haiti, which is food self-sufficiency. Haiti is dependent on U.S. agribusiness. So instead of providing food grown by Haitian masses to feed their own population, they want to continue export-oriented agriculture, which is going to destroy the food self-sufficiency of the country. Then they want to build yet more sweatshops for Canadian and U.S. multinational corporations and open new tourist resorts in the country. Thus, right on the eve of the hurricane, of the earthquake, Clinton toured the country while it was under occupation with a blueprint really for selling Haiti to U.S. multinational corporations. The U.S. Clinton in particular have laid the grounds really therefore for turning the earthquake into the social catastrophe that it's become. As we know, the earthquake killed 300,000 people, drove over 1.5 million people out of their homes, and destroyed most of the government buildings in Haiti. And if you just contrast that to what happened in Chile just recently, you can't imagine a more different situation. Because of how deregulated the society became as a result of U.S. neoliberalism, there was no regulations on building. By contrast, in Chile, where the Salvador Allende government in the early 1970s regulated the construction of buildings, when the Chilean earthquake struck, hardly any buildings were damaged. Hardly any people were killed. You compare that to Haiti, because of U.S. neoliberalism, the country was absolutely devastated. And after the earthquake, President Obama promises that it would be different than Katrina under Bush, that it would be different, that instead of abandoning the people like Bush did under Katrina because he didn't care about black people, Kanye West was right, despite what Bill Clinton, despite what people have said, in particular George Bush. And what we've seen in Haiti is the reality that Obama has done very much what Bush did to New Orleans in Katrina. The first thing they did in the aftermath of the earthquake was not rush aid, but rush troops. 20,000 troops deployed to Haiti. Instead of welcoming refugees into the country, they sent a flotilla of ships to strangle the country to prevent refugees from finding succor and safety in the United States. And they basically asserted the U.S. as the direct dictatorial power in the country. And in so doing, they actually impeded the relief effort. So instead of bringing relief, they did the exact opposite. And they directed the bulk of the funds that they did release not to the Haitian government. Hardly a dime went to the Haitian government. It all went to these international non-governmental organizations. So the U.S., the other powers in the U.N. did that immediately. And then secondarily, they promised, oh, we're going to help. After we've got it stabilized, we're going to help the country with aid for reconstruction and development. And this was just a grand public relations operation in result. They have not delivered hardly a dime to the country. They promised $10.3 billion, but now only 22% of that money has been released. Now, 10 months after the earthquake, and the U.S. up until last week hadn't even released a dime of the $1 billion that they promised. The NGOs that got all of the generous donations from the people of the world to help in Haiti, they've not even released the majority of their funds. And if you listen to interviews with people in the tent camps and the refugee camps, they hardly ever see the NGOs actually doing anything on the ground to help these the desperate people who are still living in horrific conditions in Haiti. But even if the money was distributed, it's for the Interim Haiti Reconstruction Commission, it's tied to the same old neoliberal plans of export-oriented agriculture, of sweatshop development, and tourism. So even if they did give the money, it's not going to be in the interest of the vast majority. So the reality... And you know, the reality is Haiti is simply not a priority for the United States. They want to stabilize and colonially control it, but they're not really about the development of the country in the interest of the Haitian majority. What they're really interested in is continuing the occupation, not only of Haiti, but of Iraq and Afghanistan, and into expanding the war into Pakistan, which is to the tune of $4 trillion, spending $14 trillion on bailing out the financial institutions. So essentially, they care about profit over people. As a result, the earthquake victims and the whole country of Haiti were left to rot under the UN gunpoint. 1.5 million people are still in refugee camps, in tent squatter settlements in and around Port-au-Prince, living under tents and tarps. Not even, you know, and hardly any of the rubble has been removed. Only 2% of the rubble from the earthquake has been removed. Now, 10 months after the earthquake, hardly any reconstruction has happened. There are only 13,000 temporary shelters built out of the promised 130,000 shelters. People have been left in poverty, dispossession, starvation, and subject to disease. And almost on cue, now we see the consequences of what the U.S. has done and what Bill Clinton has done in Haiti in the Hurricane Tomas and the cholera outbreak. The Hurricane Tomas, thank God, it was less severe than people were worried, but it tore through refugee camps, ripping up the tents and tarps, forcing people who were already homeless to be out of their tents, subject to the floodwaters from the hurricane. But even worse has been this cholera outbreak, which now has killed, I think it's 1,000 people, and 17,000 people have caught the disease, and the World Health Organization is predicting 270,000 people are going to contract cholera in the coming years in Haiti. And the real people to blame for this is Bill Clinton, the United States, and the United Nations, because this epidemic did not need to happen. If you think that People don't know for sure, but the suspicion is that the UN troops from Nepal, who are there occupying the section of Haiti, may be the source of the cholera strain, because cholera has not been seen in Haiti for over 50 years. So it's been brought from somewhere else in this disease-prone condition. We don't know that for sure, and there's been all sorts of hemming and hawing and inadequate investigation to find out where the cholera epidemic has come from. But we know for sure that the U.S. is directly to blame for the sanctions that prevented the building of an adequate sewage system and water treatment system in the very river, I don't know how to pronounce it, the Artibonite River, which is where the cholera epidemic started. George Bush stopped the funding from the Inter-American Development Bank, which would have paid for the building of a sewage and water treatment system, which would have stopped this cholera epidemic. So directly, the U.S. is responsible for this. So they've caused this absolute catastrophe. And what have they done when they've been presented with this? They've treated it just the way they treated the earthquake. Instead of doing anything to help, what they've done is militarize the situation, because people are pissed off throughout the country about the UN occupation and the cholera epidemic. So there have been protests against the UN saying the UN is responsible for cholera, and the UN troops have tear gassed, shot into crowds, and repressed the demonstration because they see it as a security problem, not an emergency health disaster. So the U.S., U.N., and Bill Clinton in particular are the principal causes of the catastrophe. They imposed the neoliberal plan. They gutted the social reforms from the Haitian state. They stopped mass movements for improvement of people's living standards, all to reassert U.S. power in the region, all to exploit the poverty of the Haitian majority. They in no way have been engaged in humanitarian interventions. In fact, the opposite. This has been a predatory intervention into Haiti against the interests of the vast majority. And a great American revolutionary socialist named John Reed aptly described the myth of humanitarian intervention this way. He said, "Uncle Sam never gives anybody something for nothing. He comes along with a sack stuffed with hay in one hand and a whip in the other. Anyone who accepts Uncle Sam's promises at their face value will find that they must be paid for in sweat and blood." What John Reed said at the beginning of the 20th century is certainly true at the beginning of the 21st century. So that's why we have to demand, and we have to build solidarity and protest movement to demand that the U.S. and the U.N. have got to get out of Haiti. They are doing nobody any good. We have to demand the democratically elected president of the country has the right to return, and that Haitians should decide who controls and is the elected leadership of their government, not the U.S., not the U.N., not France, and not Canada. And instead of aid and charity, Haiti deserves reparations. France should be made to pay $21 billion back to the people of Haiti. Only with that kind of money, only with that space for determining their own destinies, will the Haitian masses have the ability to control and build a society and their interests. And we have to stand with the new movement that Kim is going to talk about that's developing in the streets of Haiti, that hopefully would be the germ, the beginning, the genesis of a new resistance that we need to build solidarity with, because only resistance is going to provide a solution in Haiti. Only resistance is going to provide a solution in the United States, because imperialism only has blood on its hands, and we have to get it out of the way of the Haitian people.
That was Ashley Smith. He dismissed the recent Haitian elections as efforts by the U.S. to legitimize its invasion and subjugation of Haiti. Kim Ives is an editor of the progressive publication Haiti Liberté. Ives says the U.S. pretends to favor democracy, but instead imposes its own dictatorship.
Haiti really is, as Somali would say, an icebreaker in history. It's often the country that forges the way. It was with the revolutions in Latin America. It was the country that broke the chains of colonialism, not at their weakest link, but at the strongest. And they did this and set forth the process that began to liberate the entire continent. And in many ways, they did that again in 1990.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
This paradigm that the U.S. changed that year, because what they were doing before, and it's important for us to remember these things, is they used to dominate after years of colonialism and outright domination with their armies, as in 1915, troops came in, it was clear, there they were Americans. They had white skin, they were doing the job very clearly. And then they said, well, you know, let's do something else. Let's do a change where we put a black face on it. And they began to put in, not just in Haiti, but throughout the world, put on a brown face, yellow face, red face, whatever face that will make the people think that's their people. And in fact, they were, but it was of a different class. It was a class war. And in fact, Duvalier had his army, the Macoutes. Pinochet had Chileans, you had Videla, you had Somoza. And the U.S. looked and they said, damn, we're starting to have too many Che Guevaras, too many revolutions. We have to change it. And so they came up with this notion of demonstration elections, where they're going to come, hold an election, and this guy has been elected, or this woman has been elected by the people. And we're going to ask the army to go back in their barracks. And now Che Guevara can't come and say that it's time for a revolution because we have elections. Everything's done. There's no more dictators. But if they get in trouble, now we need a force. What force are we going to use? We'll have a force nobody can object to. The International Peacekeeping Force. They're going to come in. They're going to do it. They are our new army. They are our new arm of international capital, of defending the status quo. And we come in and we can put all kinds of nationalities in there. We'll have Pakistanis, we'll have Sri Lankans, we'll have Bolivians, we'll have people from around the world, and they will hold the established order. That is what is happening in Haiti. And Haiti was the first to confront those demonstration elections. They were carrying them out throughout Latin America. It was people like, well, we know their faces. I'm forgetting the guy in Argentina, Menem. I mean, here was the poster child, we could say, a guy who was supposedly elected just through huge infusions of money from the National Endowment for Democracy. And he put in place incredible a neoliberal structural adjustment of the economy, even and eventually we saw where that led to impoverishment of the masses. So Haiti said, okay, we're not going down that road. We're going down another road. And when they came with their elections in 1990, the U.S. said, well, this formula has worked everywhere else. It'll work here, too. We'll spend $36 million for our candidate, who was Marc Bazin. And they did it. But the people came behind a parish priest who had a war chest, campaign chest of $500,000. He was outspent about 72-1. And he won the election massively. In fact, they say 67%. That's not even accurate. They cut off the voting. They cut off the tallying when he reached 67% because it might have gone up to 80-90. It was a complete rout. So this was the first country that happened. And, of course, the response was coup d'etat, bring out the soldiers again in the form of General Raul Cedras and Michel Francois to drown that impudence with blood, and they did so. 5,000 people, as General Leslie Given, people who were killed during that 91 to 94 coup. And we put in a U.S. occupation, finally. And that's why I think, in fact, in the final analysis, that U.S. occupation, which then was transferred to the U.N., the U.S. comes in and does the heavy lifting and then gives it to the caretakers. It was to stop a revolution. That was what was about to happen in Haiti. They couldn't stop the resistance. And they came in with the UN, and gradually the people beat it back. They left, and they said, well, you know, maybe it can go again. And then Aristide came back again in 2000. And they said, well, this time we have to really do it right. And they set about doing, once again, another coup. But this time, it wasn't done in the course of 7 months. It took 3 years to do it. Economic embargo. Diplomatic isolation. They used a contra force working out of the Dominican Republic. They used all the elements to isolate and undermine and sabotage this government of Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And when they managed to get him out, again, U.S. troops, this time supported with French and Canadians, who were co-conspirators in this international coup, came in, and then 3 months later, in June 2004, handed off the occupation to the UN. And for the past 6 years, they have been running it. But not running, they've been doing it, but the U.S., UN, the U.S., Canada, and France have been running it.
Kim Ives of Haiti Liberté speaking in Harlem. An American delegation recently returned from Geneva, Switzerland, where they delivered reports on the state of human rights in the United States. One of the organizations involved was the U.S. Human Rights Network, which compiled a 400-page report. In 2009, the Obama administration sabotaged a United Nations conference on racism in Geneva, just as George Bush's administration had done in 2001. U.S. Human Rights Network Executive Director Ajamu Baraka says President Obama is trying to win points for joining the UN's Human Rights Council.
I have a little bit of a disagreement with some of my friends in the human rights field who were a little bit overly exuberant in their praise of the government for participating in this process. This process is a mandatory process. And what the Obama administration attempted to do was to try to manipulate that process for their own political ends. They wanted to, they have an objective, which is to try to reassert leadership within the Human Rights Council. And in order to do that, they thought they could use the UPR process as a propaganda tool to, in fact, do that. So they wanted to have a series of dog and pony shows across the country where they were going to be pretending to be consulting with civil society, and they were going to then go to Geneva and hold up this model as a model of democracy and suggest that they could be the leaders of human rights in the world again, because their main objective was to use the human rights framework and the council to advance their geopolitical interests, primarily focused on countries like Iran. So we mucked up that process for them because we started raising these critical questions, including issues around political prisons in the U.S., and that helped to undermine that particular objective. So no, they had to participate in the process, and they came into the process and came into the review, and they advanced some preposterous kinds of assertions about the fact that they don't have to ratify treaties because they implement the treaty before they ratify it, which is a complete twist of logic. So we don't heap praise on this administration for being part of a process that they had to be a part of from the very beginning. One thing we wanted to make sure that people understood was that in the midst of this economic crisis, for example, that the U.S. fails to recognize economic, social, and cultural rights as legitimate human rights. Therefore, they're trying to avoid the obligations that the government has, the state has, to address the plight of poor people and working class people in this country, to ensure that governmental resources are directed and utilized to address the sufferings of people in this country. They instead will assert that these are just normal policy kinds of decisions and that there's no objective obligation to do anything special to address the economic contradictions here in this country. So in our reports, we have raised the issues of health disparities. We've raised the fact that there's a governmental policy to destroy public housing here in this country. We have addressed the issue of environmental racism, environmental justice issues, and how that disproportionately impacts on the African American, Latino, and Native communities. We have talked about the disparities in funding of education, and all of these we have raised as the result of governmental decisions, governmental policies that have resulted in individuals and communities not being able to realize their full human rights. What we're doing and what we did in this report and what we're doing in building this movement is, in fact, the directive that we got from people like W.B. Du Bois and more specifically people like Malcolm, that said that we've got to elevate this struggle in this country from a mere civil rights struggle, a constitutional-based struggle, to a human rights struggle. We've got to link in and connect up with struggling people around the world who have common interests and common problems like ours. And we've got to build movement in order to advance our fundamental human rights. So that's what we're trying to do in this process. And those issues that we spoke to are reflected in this 400-page report that serve as the main basis for many of the questions that governments raise with the U.S.
Ajamu Baraka was speaking on Jazz with Justice, Dr. Jared Ball's program on WPFW Radio in Washington. No one has written more criticism of Barack Obama than Paul Street, whose latest book is titled The Empire's New Clothes, Barack Obama and the Real World of Power. We asked Paul Street, how deeply in trouble is Obama after Republican gains in the midterm elections?
Well, you know, sometimes I wonder if he feels like I put him in deep. Doesn't he want Trevor to run further to the right? Now he's going to have a deficit commission. He's going to go after Social Security. We're going to increase retirement age, deficit reduction, some of the things that he promised to his Wall Street funders and backers. Bill Clinton liked that big right-wing midterm in 94. He got to run against. He got to blame some of his own ineptitude, or maybe I should say his own centrism and his own business-friendly values. And then he could point at them, and he could say that they were obstructing him. Just, I don't know. Maybe this will take a little bit of the heat off of him. You know, I think Obama could come back. I'm one who thinks he could have a second term, not so much because of any positive accomplishments as because if he gets any kind of economic upturn, and the historical data shows that he gets job growth in the last quarter, the last 3 months of an election year, the incumbent tends to come back. You know, now the Republicans are going to own some of this fundamentally screwed up capitalist economy that we have right now. They're going to own a little bit of that. They're not going to have any solutions to it. They're not going to increase employment numbers by any policies they do. It remains to be seen how much trouble he's in. Now, we're in trouble insofar as we think we can get anything progressive from government. Of course, we didn't get anything progressive happened down in Washington, D.C. in the 2 years when Obama came in with a 54% mandate amidst an epic crisis of neoliberal capitalism. And he had significant majorities, including for a time 60-vote filibuster-proof majority in the Senate. And that's supposedly everything we were told by the people who tell us it's about election and the people who tell us it's about having Democrats in, that we've got to subordinate everything we do to them and line it up so the Democrats are in charge. Well, they had it. And we got nothing. We got nothing in terms of the progressive agenda. And that was with that alignment of the stars. So what in the name of God do we think we're going to get out of Washington with these hardcore proto-fascistic white nationalist, hyper-ignorant, paranoid-style Tea Party Republicans in there? We can forget about that. So maybe we can focus about other things and try to influence Washington. We're not going to influence it any right now. We're going to rebuild our strength.
Well, Obama did lose half of his blue dog Democrat. Wouldn't that tend to deprive him of some of the cover, political cover that he needs? Now it looks like he'll have to be in an even more overt and dramatic relationship with Republicans if he's going to.
Well, that's true. That's right. He does not have the cover for the centrism and the right-leaning policy within the Democratic Party. they actually, ironically enough, the right-wing rebellion took out some of the more right-wing Democrats, leaving a more, I guess, and I hate to call them liberal, but a more liberal, a cadre of what's remaining of the Democrats. Yeah, that's right. And then he'll have to more overtly connect directly with the right wing, which his history tells me he'll be willing to do. However, we can expect him to do that. Obama became Obama because he was the first black editor of the Harvard Law Review. And how did he do that? By making an end run around progressive law students and forming an alliance with the Federalist Society, who were far right wing law students. They now populate our federal bench and regularly hand down miserably right-wing decisions, and that's who his buddies were. That he vaulted himself into prominence in that way at the very beginning.
And so that's his MO to date.
That's what I saw when I was in Chicago too. Yeah, all kinds of friendships and alliances with the right-wingers down in Springfield, and we could talk about his U.S. Senate career too in those types of terms. I mean, this guy went around campaigning for the presidency, praising Ronald Reagan. You know, about the sense of order. That Ronald Reagan helped impose in America, that people wanted in this country, and you know, the way he changed the national conversation and all that kind of stuff. Ronald Reagan was the most arch plutocratic right wing backlash president since that we've ever had.
The corporate media, of course, say the clear winner in the midterm elections was the Tea Party. But what the hell is a Tea Party?
Well, the Tea Party was sold by the media as an independent grassroots social movement, you know, outside of the Republican Party. It is absolutely no such thing whatsoever. Tony DiMaggio and I have looked at this in depth. We're doing a book that should come out in March, I hope, called Crashing the Tea Party, Mass Media, and the Campaign to Remake American Politics. The Tea Party was a product of the Koch brothers, the billionaire oil plutocrats, who fund Americans for Prosperity, which is a funding seat group for a lot of what passes for local Tea Party chapters. It's a product of Freedom Works, which is funded by large corporate businesses, the petroleum industry, the financial industry, and it's headed by Dick Armey, and Dick Armey is a Republican political operative. And what the Tea Party really was, we infiltrated some of their meetings and went to them, and these folks had no sense whatsoever what a social movement is about or grassroots at all. Relatively unpopulated meetings in Chicago where Republican hacks came in and gave them lectures on how to get the vote out for the Republican Party. You know what the Tea Party is? It's just a bunch of really, really loud, obnoxious, more stridently racist, more stridently poor-hating, more stridently liberal and leftist-hating Republicans than the usual fare. And the Tea Party is very, to me, emblematic of where the Republican Party has been going over many years. And what the Tea Party did was help rebrand the GOP, which is even more unpopular than Obama, and helped the GOP take advantage of the bad employment numbers during the midterm elections. And they're a media creation, too. One thing Tony and I did was do the LexisNexis media database research and just total up the amount of times the media insisted on referring to this as a powerful and independent and nonpartisan people's movement and a social movement. I mean, to the point of absurdity, they can't mention 17,000 or 18,000 people showing up and marching in Detroit for the U.S. Social Forum, which was a gathering of leftists and progressives and labor people and anti-imperialists and anti-corporatists and pro-environmentalists. Didn't exist. So it was almost completely off the radar screen. 500 people showed up in a kind of a flop for a National Tea Party Convention in Nashville about the same time last summer, and it was front page news. And there are many, many examples of that locally and nationally where, you know, anything we do. I was just with our BAR comrade Bruce Dixon. I was part of a significant anti-war march in Chicago a few weeks back. 5,000-6,000 people up and down Michigan Avenue and State Street in the Loop. We owned the streets for a while, protesting the imperial wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan and Somalia and Ethiopia. I looked at the 10 o'clock news. It didn't happen. I looked at the Sun-Times, the Chicago Tribune the next day. It didn't happen. It was flushed down. It was deleted from history even before it occurred. And I said to one of the organizers, if we dressed up like George Washington, you know, with fife and drum and a tricorner ad or whatever, you know, and call ourselves a Tea Party, we wouldn't have front page news.
Now, the Tea Party does benefit right-wing Democrats in a kind of way, doesn't it? It's what Obama supporters would love to fight instead of struggling against Obama's right-wing policies.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, scream at it. Scream about them, call them fascists, and say the brown shirts are coming, and just go hysterical about them, kind of like Rachel Maddow and Keith Olbermann did, and make so much fun of them because they're so crazy. And some of them are really crazy. I mean, Christine O'Donnell was just, you know, she was out the box. And then that's that Sharon Angle woman, whatever she was smoking down there in Arizona. You know, some of them do get a little kooky. So, yeah, they're a perfect foil for the right wing. Joe Biden did this. I remember he gave a speech in September leading up to the midterm elections. Joe Biden did, where he said, listen, all you progressives who are threatening not to vote or don't seem enthusiastic, you know, as these elections are coming up, don't compare us to the Almighty, he said. Compare us to the alternative. And the alternative is, of course, he's crazy, wacky. The Republican Tea Party, he called it. That's what he called it. So, of course, if we were asking them to act in any elementary way on any part of the progressive agenda, anything, you know, just investigate Bush. Do anything for the Employee Free Choice Act. Do anything for the trade legislation reform, you'd say. Do anything for green jobs. You know, amidst this epic structural mass unemployment now, the functional unemployment rate is 16%. Just do one thing, anything. If you ask us to do that, you're asking us to be gods, right? It's typical of an abusive relationship, if you ask me. It's like, we're not going to give you, we're not going to meet any of your needs. We're not going to do anything you want, but you need to shut the heck up. Go sit there over the corner, let the real men of politics do their stuff, and remember, honey, though we don't want to do anything for you, we do love you, be quiet, sit over there, and we're protecting you against these people who are even worse. They'll abuse you even more. So we might abuse you, but these kooks over here will abuse you more, so you need to be quiet now.
But the secret is, and it's not a secret because it's the title to one of your most recent articles, Note to the Left, Obama Hates You.
Right. It's not love. It is hatred, right? When you're telling people to just be quiet and sit over there in the corner. That's what we've been all my life. I've been watching this. I'm just sick of it. I can't take it anymore. All my life I've heard this. Heard from my grandfather. I heard it to some extent from my father. I grew up in a liberal household. You know, that's right. You've got some good ideas here. But watch out for them. Those Republicans are coming. And we're protecting you. But really, it shows some of the many, many ways in which they smack us down. The top Democrats smack us down. It's not just seduction. It's not just dreamy. A lot of the narrative about what happened to us progressives and the Democrats is kind of like a redo of the Bobby Kennedy campaign in 68, you know, the dreamy Bobby and his supposed poor people's campaign. And a lot of leftists it's kind of like Obama, you know, got sucked into this notion that this guy was a different type of ruling class candidate. He's really going to deliver the goods and do progressive things, and I sort of fell in love with them, you know, and we all got kind of carried. I mean, I didn't, but, you know, we all got carried away with. But what I developed in that essay is there's another analogy from 1968 that Obama, we need to think about Obama and Rahm Emanuel and Joe Biden and all the top Democrats a little bit more in terms of how they relate to the left, too. And that's Richard Daley beating the crap. Having his cops beat the crap out of the anti-war protesters and shouting down progressives and cussing them out from the convention floor at the International Amphitheater in August of 1968. And what I do is, in that essay, I go through a lot of the different ways in which we've just been taking punches to the gut from these people for some time, particularly from Rahm Emanuel, who now is going to be the mayor of my city, Chicago. That appears to be a done deal already.
Was Rahm Emanuel just being Rahm Emanuel, or was he also being Obama's alter ego?
I think that's right. I think he's Obama's alter ego. See, I think that this whole line that you hear from liberal leftists like John Nichols and Katrina Vandenhoeven, People of the Nation, that Nichols said this to me once at a meeting in Chicago. You know, he knows our analysis, and he wants to act on it. We're talking about Obama here. He wants to do the progressive thing. If we just need to get our stuff together enough to make him do what he really wants to do, which is introduce a progressive left agenda. And I don't think that understands Obama at all. It does not relate to his early career at Harvard Law, where he was regularly cutting deals with the far right wing, the Federalist Society. As I said before, that achieved his notoriety. It doesn't relate very well to his career in Springfield, which again and again involved making deals with far right Republicans and disrespecting what progressives wanted. I was very painfully involved in one of those episodes around the ex-offender prison legislation in Illinois in 2003 and 2004. And if people, they might want to take a look at, to think that Obama wants to deal with, they ought to take a careful look at the book he rolled out. It really was a campaign book. It was really the first statement, in a way, of his presidential campaign. It was called The Audacity of Hope, which is just loaded with references to the unrealistic and sort of stupid and unrespectable, wild-eyed, windmill-tilting, quixotian nature of left analysis and left beliefs and left values. And you know, as I said, it praises Ronald Reagan.
Paul Street, author of The Empire's New Clothes. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio, produced by the same team that brings you blackagendareport.com on the Internet. I'm Glenn Ford. My co-host Nellie Bailey returns next week. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Jason Taubenfeld.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.